Thank you, Harry. My name is Toni Curry, and I'm a very grateful recovering alcoholic. You know, it is a powerful experience to be with you here in this group. There is so much spiritual energy. You can just feel it, and it's wonderful to be a part of it. I feel so lucky to have met Lucille and Harry down in St. Simon's, and that prompted my being here. And Harry, I appreciate you and the committee's invitation to participate in this fellowship with you. It's a wonderful experience, and what powerful messages we have already heard. And I want to tell you, Burke, you and Martha both, how much you have enriched me. Just wonderful. We are a crying bunch. I have my Kleenex in my pocket. And Martha, as I look in the mirror and hear your story and look around this room, I think there's a real possibility that black hair and blue eyes is a physical combination that is peculiar to the disease of alcoholism. I'm happy to be here with you. And I'm supposed to tell you what it was like and what happened and what it's like now. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me everything in the world that I want in my life. Everything that means anything to me today is a direct result of my being an alcoholic and recovering in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have so much gratitude in my heart for that. It's difficult to describe it because it was a nightmare for so many years. It was about this time of the year when the end of my nightmare was happening, a long nightmare. In the fall of 1973, I was trying as hard as anybody could try not to take pills and not to drink. I would go 2 months dry and be drunk for 4 days. I'd be dry for 2 months and drunk for 3 days. I'd be dry for 1 month and drunk for 5 days. And that's the way my efforts were going. I was trying to hide the fact that I'd been in jail. I was trying to hide the fact that I was about to lose my children. I was trying to take an abuse in a desperate effort not to drink. And I drank on top of an abuse, not one time, but a number of times, knowing I could die. And the compulsion to take a drink more powerful than the fear of dying. I don't think anybody except those of us who've experienced that compulsion could understand that powerlessness to take a drink. It was a horrendous time in my life. Christmas Day was, I hope I never forget. I had tried to do my Christmas shopping and I had managed to buy only 3 presents. I was to have Christmas dinner for the whole family. I had to call my parents 2 days before Christmas and say, "You'll have to get the children. I cannot stand up to cook. I cannot get the groceries. I cannot get sober." And my children were with my parents for Christmas Day. And on Christmas Day morning, I woke up. I'd been drinking for days, taking pills for days, and I looked out my window, and it was a little bit light outside, and the clock said 7 o'clock, and I closed my eyes after taking another drink, and when I opened my eyes again, it was a little bit light outside my window, and the clock said 7 o'clock. Only 12 hours had gone by, and that was Christmas Day, 1973. Alone, without my family, without my children, without the cheerfulness and frivolity of Christmas Day and the caring spirit. And I hope I never forget that day. When I got out of treatment 3 months later, those 3 packages that I had bought were on my living room floor, still unwrapped. And that was the way my life was going, in total despair, in a black hole I did not know how to get out of. And saw no alternatives. And that was a long way from the girl who dedicated her life to full-time Christian service at the age of 16, who was president of the National Honor Society, who was an honor graduate from her high school, who was president of the school chorus, president of the school bank, on the student council, one of the most popular students, active member in the First Baptist Church of her community, in the choir, in the Baptist Training Union, in Sunday school, GAs, YWAs, whatever else the Baptist Church had, I was in. That was a long way from that girl. Lucille and Harry and I were sharing last night about that. I tried so hard to feel God. Every time Billy Graham came through town, I rededicated my life to full-time Christian service. And I kept trying to feel God. And I never felt that conscious contact until I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I tried as hard as anybody could try. But I never felt God until the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went on to college, married a very successful young businessman, had three beautiful children, and nothing in my lifestyle looked like somebody who was going to turn out to be an alcoholic, except for one thing. Alcoholism ran rampant in my family. There was alcoholism, and there were non-drinkers, and there was nothing in between. And so if I had been a little bit savvy about this disease, having an inherited trait, I might have not drunk. I might have listened to that omen. But my hunch is that if somebody had told me when I started drinking in my 20s that I was going to turn out to be an alcoholic, my hunch is that I would have said, uh-uh, not me. I'm different. I can handle it. I can control it. And that's what I said. I know I'm going to drink, but I'm not going to turn out to be like my daddy. I'm going to handle it. Today I hear my 17-year-old daughter saying, well, Mom, when I'm old enough, I'm going to drink, but I'm not going to be like you. I'm going to control it. So we see this disease possibly going on through generations. I don't think I would have believed it. I thought I was unique. I thought I could handle it. My problem started when I quit smoking, Martha, in my 30s. I had been a social drinker for 10 years. You would have called me a social drinker. When I look back on it and am honest about that period of drinking, it was rigid control drinking. I've had control drinking and I've had uncontrolled drinking, and I have never really experienced social drinking. The freedom to drink without having to worry about it, or without trying to control it, trying to stop. So for 10 years I controlled it, and when I quit smoking I got real nervous. Couldn't sleep, couldn't eat, started going around to doctors saying, I'm a nervous wreck, you've got to help me. And they said, we can help, help is at hand. We have these little pills. They said, you take these little pills and you will be able to sleep and you will be calm. So I took Nembutal first. And over a period of the next many months, and you'll have to forgive me because about 4 years of my life, 4 years, 5 years, something like that, is by and large a blackout. So time frames escape me in the present time. But for the next many months, I took many different kinds of pills. And I abused and was addicted to, at different times, Nembutal, Valium, Librium, Seconal, Elavil, Triavil, Sinequan. Whatever the popular drugs of the day were, I took, abused, and was addicted to. And I hated the way pills made me feel. I couldn't stand the feeling. And I was looking for a good feeling. I wanted to feel good. I wanted a buzz on. And pills didn't give me a buzz on. And I stopped taking the pills and continued to do what I thought was social drinking. And within a matter of days, I was drinking alcoholically. And I never drank any differently from that time on. I started drinking daily, and it took a very short year and a half later for me to be admitted to the Emory University psychiatric ward. I had become dysfunctional in a year and a half. I couldn't take care of my children. I couldn't get them to school, kindergarten. I couldn't feed them. I got my days and nights mixed up. I began to withdraw from my friends. I pulled away from the bridge group, the garden club, took the kids out of dancing, music lessons, just withdrew from the world and very quickly holed up with my bottle. At Emory, they said that I had marital problems and that I had mental and emotional problems and that I was not an alcoholic. And I thought, how wise. And they said, we're going to help you with your mental and emotional problems and your marital problems. Then you will no longer have the desire to drink to excess. And so we think you can social drink, and you just try that and see how you feel about it. And then if you can't, just quit. So I bought a bottle on the way home, bought a bottle of wine on the way home, and I was drunk within hours and off and running again, but I had learned a real valuable thing. Even if they didn't think I had a problem with hard liquor, I knew I had a problem with hard liquor. So I switched to beer and wine, and I got just as drunk and twice as fat. And they sent me to a psychiatrist to see 3 times a week. And that psychiatrist said, I can still hear this ringing in my ears too, that I was so emotionally and mentally ill that I would never be able to live a day of my life without Thorazine. And he put me on massive doses of Thorazine. And that I do recall, I believe, is about the worst year of my life. Thorazine turned me into an instant zombie. I was dysfunctional on Thorazine just as I was dysfunctional on every other drug. The doctor said that Thorazine would help me to organize my thoughts. My experience with Thorazine was that it actually stripped me of the ability to think, and we didn't have to worry about organizing any thoughts. But that's when I began to feel like I was in a hole. And I didn't exactly want to live, and I didn't exactly want to die. Thorazine stripped me of the ability to care. It stripped me of the ability to feel. And that's the worst thing drugs and alcohol do to us, I think. So we can't care and we can't feel. And I knew I loved my children, but somehow the feeling just wasn't there. You know, intellectually I knew it, but I couldn't find the caring. I couldn't find the motivation to love, to feel. A horrible time in my life. That's the worst thing that happens to us. During this time, I discovered another horrible thing, and that is that my telephone was tapped and that there was a private detective following me. Well, this scared me again, and I tell you about that because my pattern of drinking changed again. I'm always looking at other things. I always projected the blame for my problems onto other things. It was my marriage. It was the fact that my telephone was tapped. Private detectives were following me. If I just had some freedom, by golly, I wouldn't need to drink. No wonder I drink the way I do. I projected the blame onto everything but alcohol and pills. When I realized the private detective was following me, I was afraid to go into the liquor store. So I began to find things by accident in the grocery stores, in the drug stores that had alcohol in them. I discovered that Micrin had 18% alcohol. Scope mouthwash had 18% alcohol. I had the sweetest breath in town. Vanilla extract had, I believe it was 68% alcohol. I believe lemon extract had 84%. I drank whatever had alcohol in it. And you have to get the picture of where I was at that time in my life. I was married to a very wealthy man. We had a gorgeous home and many acres of land and fancy automobiles and many boats and material luxuries. And anything that I wanted, I could have. And I was saying to people who were saying I'm an alcoholic, I say, no, I'm not an alcoholic. Look at my lifestyle. Alcoholics drink out of a brown bag down on Skid Row. Look at my lifestyle. There's no way. I'm better than that. I can't be an alcoholic. I'm a school teacher. I'm college educated. I have 3 beautiful children. I have all this wealth. I have full-time help. There's no way somebody in my station in life can be an alcoholic. And there I was in my third-story bedroom drinking vanilla flavoring. The insidious denial of this disease that in the face of stark truths, our brains are so deluded that we cannot see what's happening to us. Well, it got worse. I have horrible memories of this disease as a family disease and how my children were harmed and my parents and my husband and even my friends, people around me. Nobody escapes. And it got worse, and my marriage ended, And I moved into a condominium. The children were allowed to live with me, but I was so sick they were shuffled back and forth from time to time to different people in their lives to take care of, because I could not take care of my children. As hard as I tried and as much as I wanted to, I could not take care of my children. If I ever thought that I was in trouble as a married alcoholic, I had no idea what trouble I could get into as a single alcoholic. Now, don't get your hopes up, because I am not going to tell you the sordid details of my single alcoholic life. Because it says our stories disclosed in a general way. And it is a general way that you are going to get here this morning. But I will tell you a cute story that happened to me 2 or 3 weeks ago when I was at a convention. I am now a professional in the field, and I was at a convention called ALMACA. Some of you may be familiar with it. It's the Association of Labor Management Administrators and Consultants on Alcoholism, which tells you why we call it ALMACA. And we were in Minneapolis, and I could not afford to go for the whole week, and so I had a short 2.5 days to really accomplish everything I needed to accomplish in the way of letting people know about my new program and doing some marketing and so forth. And so I was trying to schedule my appointments and not waste my time while I was there. So I called the hotel operator, and I said, "Operator, this is Miss Curry in room 1513. Would you please have Mr. Howard call me in room 1513? And would you also have Mr. Richards call me in my room, please? And would you please tell Mr. Rowland that I returned his call?" And on and on and on I went. And so she said, "Miss Curry, is there anything else you'd like?" "No, thank you, that's all." 30 seconds after I hung up, phone rings. The operator, and she says, "Miss Curry, Mr. Howard and Mr. Richards are sharing a room. Shall I send separate messages?" I said, "Operator, where were you when I was drinking?" But it's a miracle I lived through that period. Going out to bars every night, alone, coming home 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. Sometimes my children were with me, sometimes they weren't. Sometimes I'd leave them alone, sometimes they had somebody to take care of them. A horrible nightmare for all of us. God takes care of children and drunks. We are living proof that God takes care of children and drunks. I'm so grateful that nothing really fatal happened to any of us during that time. Well, let me tell you about the beginning of the end. When I was drinking on top of an abuse, I don't know if you've ever done that or not, but you get deathly ill. And one of the real realities that I have of this disease as a family disease was that the last time I drank on top of an abuse, I fell and cracked my head open on a chair that had a wooden frame. And my son had the responsibility and the presence of mind to try to call an ambulance and a doctor. And he was 8 years old. And my daughters had the responsibility of trying to drag Mom to a bed to get help for her, and to mop up the blood on the white carpeting. And my girls were 5 and 6 years old. And that is alcoholism. That's what it is. Everybody's scarred. Nobody escaping. I still have the worst picture of the face of my little boy standing on our front porch begging me at midnight not to go out to get another drink. And that little face still standing there, scared to death, when I got back a few minutes later. And he didn't know if I'd come back. And all the times they tried to wake me up and I couldn't be roused, when they thought I was dead, and I had the gall to say in treatment how grateful I was that I had not harmed my children. I had the gall to say that. These are horrible scars that we have and that we have recovered from and that we live around and have made benefit us in our lives today. The last time I drank on alcohol abuse, my children were taken away from me, and I knew they were not coming back. They had left before, but we had shuffled back and forth. But there was a permanency about this one, and I knew my children were not coming back. I lost custody of them in the divorce, and I knew that it was over, that the role of mother to me was gone. I didn't want to live. I lay in the bed for 5 days with the sheets pulled up over my head. I just did not want to live. But I didn't exactly want to die either. I just couldn't see an alternative. I couldn't see a way out. When I had moved into the condominium and the children were living with me, I had tried to find a condominium that was real close to a private school that my children attended, and I had to drive there 4 times a day, which is a tremendous handicap if you're an addict, to have to go 4 times a day anywhere and to keep a chemical balance in your, the right chemical balance so that you don't go into DTs on your way home or see two of everything. That was before I learned to close one eye. And that you can get there without the headmaster taking you out of the carpool line, which happened to me on a number of occasions. I was trying to find a condominium that was close to the school, and I wound up buying one that was 10 or 12 miles away from that school, and I could not explain it to you then, except that it had trees. And I was leaving large acreage, and I felt guilty about taking my children to a small condominium with no yard. And this little unit had trees. And that's the only reason I could have told you that I bought that condo. And that year that I was there, I lay there drunk in my bed most of the time, unable to take care of my children, with a chain on the door, hoping not to be found out, the telephone off the hook. Lived in fear, lived in terror that I would be found out. The children scared to death. And during that time, I could see outside my bedroom window some construction. Through the trees, I could see the line of a roof. And I would lie there in my bed with my bottle of vodka down by my side and my C-Rex pills on my nightstand. The C-Rex was the pill of the day. And I would look at that construction going on, and I could hear it, and I thought, wow, that's going to be a school. Imagine this. I'm having to drive 4 times a day all the way across country and back, and now there's going to be a school right out here in my backyard, and my kids will be able to walk right out the back door and go to school. Well, I want you to know, my friends in Alcoholics Anonymous, that building turned out to be Peachford Hospital for the Treatment of Alcoholism. And that is written on page 84 of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it says, we will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we were unable to do for ourselves. And God built a hospital for the treatment of alcoholism in my backyard. Right in my backyard. With me trying as hard as I could to get away from people who were talking to me about drinking. Me trying as hard as I could. My sponsor always said to me, God's will is going to be done, Tony, whether you like it or not. Well, Mama went to school there instead. After I lost custody of the children, I drank nonstop for 3 months. And on a morning in February, at 7 o'clock in the morning, in a long black evening dress that I'd had on for 4 days, and a crooked wig that I'd had on for 4 years. I admitted myself to Peachford Hospital. And I'd like to tell you that was my last drink, but I managed to stay sober after that treatment for 10 months and then relapsed. Very devastating relapse, because I had thought, by gosh, I've been sober 10 months now. I'll never take another drink. And these were the last 2 hospitalizations of 5 hospitalizations. And I hope that is the last. I hope there's a different ring to that word last that you hear. I had been up to that time hospitalized in 3 psychiatric institutes, I can still hear the doors closing shut behind me when I went into psychiatric institutes. If you've ever been in a psychiatric institution, there's a different sound to the door when it closes and locks than there is in any other door that closes. I can still hear that. I had been medicated to death at one of them. I had OD'd and had my stomach pumped out at another one. I had received no treatment anywhere in spite of all that hospitalization and many trips to psychiatrist's office. I had just been medicated further and wound up with two addictions. It's real important for me to remember that I can't handle medication, mind-altering medication, and other drugs any better than I can handle alcohol. But finally, after two treatments where there was good treatment, and I learned about the disease of alcoholism, thank goodness, since May 3rd of 1975, I have not had to take a drink. What I found in treatment was something I am not aware that I had ever experienced, and that was unconditional love. I did not go into treatment to get well. I went into treatment for medical attention. I was at that place where I bet a lot of you have been. I couldn't get drunk and I couldn't get sober. Didn't matter how much I drank, I couldn't get drunk. Didn't matter how long I went without it, I couldn't get sober. I was hung in the middle. And I was so scared of going into withdrawal and just too afraid, and I went into treatment for medical attention, thinking that I could there learn how to control my drinking and therefore be able to get custody of my children again. And so those were my motives. But I found unconditional love. I found people who cared about me at a time when I couldn't care about myself. It overwhelmed me. I had never felt that kind of caring before. And they said, just, we understand, we've been there, we understand, we've experienced those same things. Just hang in there with us one day at a time and it'll get better. They told me to go to 90 meetings in 90 days, and I bet I went to 190 meetings in 90 days. Because the reality for me was that nothing was available to me that had been available. I no longer had a wealthy husband to take care of me. I was on my own. I no longer had the role of a mother available to me. I was on my own. I was not a wife. The only thing I'd been is an adult. That was not available to me. I had to support myself. I had to learn to live alone for the first time in 36 years. I had to learn to handle my affairs. I had to live with the fact that I was labeled an unfit mother, the ultimate degradation to me as a woman. I had to live with the fact that there was the grease on the wall I had thrown at my daddy in a drunken fit, the hole in my bedroom carpeting where I'd set my bedroom on fire the night before I went into treatment. That's what I came home to. And I had to stay sober through all of that. If it had not been for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I would never have made it. There would not have been enough for me to hang on to go home and try to deal with all those brand new horrors in my life without the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am so grateful. I went to 190 meetings. I didn't go to a meeting every day. I went to 2 and 3 meetings every day. They said get a sponsor. I got 5 sponsors, and I needed every one of them. They held my hands through the first few years of my sobriety. When I had that relapse, one of the things I learned was that I had been able to stay sober for a short period of time for the attention that I got from other people. I had been so sick, starved for attention when I went into treatment that it had overwhelmed me. That attention had overwhelmed me, and I had been able to stay sober 10 months for the attention I got from other people. And in that relapse, I learned that my sobriety has got to be deeply, deeply personal. It's got to want to stay there whether anybody notices it or not. And that's the way I feel about my sobriety or not. I want to be sober more than anything else in the world today. I want to be sober whether you even notice or not. And I don't mean I don't like attention. But my sobriety today is not dependent on whether anybody notices that I'm sober or not. I want to be sober. I learned in that relapse, I took one drink and I tried to hide that from you. I tried to hide that drink from you. Only four or five people knew. And I hid it from the groups of Alcoholics Anonymous in Atlanta, Georgia. And I learned a real important thing in my program today. And that is, it does not matter what you know. It is what I know that I have got to live with. And I have got to live in such a way that I can like and respect Tony Curry on a daily basis. I am responsible for me. That was a valuable, valuable thing for me to learn. I learned I can't live with guilt. I can't handle that. I might as well not even do anything I'm likely to feel guilty about. Because guilt nearly... I have got to stop talking without my hands. With my hands. Guilt nearly ate me alive. I could not handle the guilt that I felt about that relapse until I became honest about it, until I opened up to you and asked for your help and got treatment again and became honest about my life again, did I begin to recover again. And it was a long, slow road back, I promise you, a long, slow road back. Wouldn't take $1 million for it today, though, because I learned firsthand what one drink will do for me. I took one drink and did not go on to drink for 2.5 months. And I might as well have been drunk every day. That one drink stripped me of every good feeling I'd had for 10 months. Everything good I had felt was gone. And one drink did it. I wouldn't take anything for learning that. And I have what today is, I believe, mature sobriety. It's stable sobriety. It's strong sobriety today. One day at a time now. I don't think in terms of how long I have. I think in terms of just being sober today. I just want to be sober today. And I'm really grateful for the experiences that led up to my feeling this way about my sobriety. I needed some mature sobriety because I had some glorious things to happen to me in sobriety and I had some absolutely traumatic things to happen. But Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a way to live where I know that I can cope with anything. There's not anything in the world that God can give me today that I can't handle. That is a real comfort to me, because think of the people out there that don't know what they can't handle. I know what I can't handle. I can handle anything as long as I don't take a drink. There's only one thing in the world that I cannot deal with, and that's alcohol and other drugs. Excuse me. As long as I don't take a drink or take a drug, there's not anything that can come my way that I can't deal with. I'm so relieved to know that. It's such a freedom. In losing custody of my children, the most traumatic thing that had happened to me up to that time, I couldn't imagine anything ever good coming out of that. I learned a wonderful thing, and that is that my children are not responsible for my sobriety. My children are not responsible for my happiness. I can be sober and I can be happy whether my children live with me or not. My sobriety and happiness are contingent on my spiritual condition on a daily basis. I talk a lot about God, too, without embarrassment. I don't understand what God is, but I know one thing. Whatever God is understands me, and I am given what I need when I need it. It seems like God knows when I have grown to a certain state where I can accept something new, and He gives that to me. And He doesn't let me have it until I have accepted fully where I am at the moment. Just like I could not recover from alcoholism until I had fully accepted the fact that I am an alcoholic. Then I could move on to recovery. I can't move on to the next step until I fully accept where I am right now. And I've experienced that over and over and over again in my sobriety. God, whatever God is, knows where I am and knows what I need. And I can't fathom that. Sometimes it seems like the way Star Wars describes it. It's a force. It's energy. It's spiritual. It certainly is not religious. But I can't fathom it. I just feel it. And it's the first time in my life I ever felt that conscious contact that I tried so hard as a teenager to find. Now I have that very real conscious contact with a God that understands me. And I talk to Him every day, and I have conversations with Him just like I talk to you. And God works in my life, and I feel it. It's incredible, incredible power. When I'd been sober a while, I began to get messages that one of my children in particular needed some different care. He had retired to his room and locked the door, and he didn't come out except to eat and to go to school because he had no support where he was. The only support he had was me, and I was not there. I was away. And it was my mother-in-law who told me this, my ex-mother-in-law, who came to me and said, "Tony, please do something about your children." And the maid said, "Tony, please do something about your children." And the governesses were saying, "Tony, please do something about your children." Well, it's real interesting that, you know, the thing we fight the hardest to ward off becomes that blessing in disguise. And by the time I was getting these messages, I was busy accepting the responsibility for my life. And I wasn't sure I could handle the responsibility of three children again. And I said, "No, I'm sorry. You know, I just can't do it. I'm sorry. Well, this may be going on, but I'm sorry. I just can't handle that. I'm afraid. I'm afraid it'll throw me, and I'm doing real well." And the messages kept coming and kept coming, and I kept fighting and fighting, like I sometimes fight God's will, until He takes the 2x4 and whacks me in the head with it. And God's will is going to be done whether I like it or not. Well, to make a long story short, I filed for custody of my children in February of that year. And it was the most frightening thing I have ever done. Because you have to see that that's the most emotionally draining thing anybody can possibly go through. And to put that many lives on the line and to be a recovered alcoholic female making $3 an hour, having to work and filing for custody where there is wealth, power, prestige, money, governesses, health. You know, it didn't even look like they ought to be in the same room. It didn't even look like that. All I knew was that God had led me to that decision. I had fought it, and He had led me to that decision, and I wasn't sure why. I wasn't sure it was for custody of the children. I thought it might be to shake up things so that there would be different treatment elsewhere. I just knew God had led me to that decision. Sometimes it seems so futile, and one day particularly so, when all the kids were piled up on my bed and Angie, my baby, said, "Mom, you wouldn't believe what they said about you. They said you used to try to run Grandpa down with the car. They said you hit him in the face and broke his glasses and cut his face all up, and that you were always passed out on the floor with no clothes on." And I thought, "Oh, wow, how do I tell this child that those things happened when I was drinking and I don't drink anymore?" It just seemed hopeless to me, and I was thinking, "Why, God, have you put us through this pain? Why are you putting us through this pain again?" And God answered me. Angie went into hysterics and started thrashing her arms and legs around on the bed when I tried to explain to her that I don't drink anymore. She was hysterically crying. And she finally calmed down and she said, "Mom, I know you did all those things, but just don't tell the judge or we'll never get to live with you." And God gave me the answer that day that I don't really need to worry about what people say about me. There is a master director in my life, and God's will is going to be done. And it doesn't matter about the little things that are said. God's will is going to be done. And I felt comfort that day that whatever happened would be best for all of us. And I went into the courtroom that day, having never been in court, scared to death. And I could tell you about many days in my life that have been glorious. That have been wonderful days in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, but this is the most profound day in my life that I want to share with you. I went into that courtroom scared to death with a sponsor on either side, and I didn't have the shakes. I had the vibrations. I was so nervous. And I got up on the witness stand, and the most incredible calm came over me. And all of a sudden, I began not only to answer the lawyer's questions, but to volunteer information. That's insanity in a courtroom. But I volunteered information, and I told the courtroom my story, just like I'm telling you, except in greater detail, because I was on the witness stand for 5 hours. And I shared my story for 5 hours. And anybody except my lawyer, who was also a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, would have said that was crazy, but he was supportive of that. And I shared my story, and I shared the horrors that I put my children through, and the blackouts, and endangering their lives, and how terrible it was for all of us. But I also shared my recovery, and that judge heard my recovery. He didn't just listen to my horrible alcoholic story. He listened to my recovery. He listened to my sober story. And one of the things I learned in that sharing was that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous had set me free. There was not anything in that courtroom, anything that that other lawyer could ask me that I was not willing to talk about. The recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous had given me a freedom I had never experienced before. I didn't have to be afraid of anything. The willingness to tell the truth had set me free. By that time in my recovery, I had done my fourth step, my fifth step. I had a God of my understanding. I had made my amends to the best of my ability. And I took stock of my life every day as I could and tried to carry the message. I worked the 12 steps the best of my ability every day and was comfortable with my life. And the willingness to tell the truth about all that had set me free. I did not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. And I was willing to tell that courtroom anything they wanted to know about me. What a freedom I experienced that day and have experienced every day since then. Because I was awarded full and permanent custody of my children that month. When everybody in the world said it couldn't be done, including my lawyer, they said it couldn't be done. But it was God's will that it be done. The most glorious day of my life. The absolute most glorious day of my life. But it was also the most traumatic day of my life. My sponsors were with me. And they believed that my children and me should be together. They described the relationship as a oneness that they had rarely seen. And it's there. It is surely there. My sponsor was a husband and wife team. And he wanted to testify to help me get my children back. And he got up on the witness stand and they said, "Mr. Johnson, can you promise us that this woman will be sober next week?" And he said, "Sir, I cannot tell you that anybody in this room will be sober next week." He said, "We cannot predict the future." And 2 minutes later, he suffered a massive heart attack and was gone. He got down from the witness stand, and he could feel the flavor in that courtroom that day. And he took Johnny, his wife, outside the courtroom door, and he said, "Honey, if we could have written the script, it couldn't be going any better than it's going for us today." He said, "Honey, we have 3 brand new grandchildren today." And he died. Well, I just thought I wouldn't live through that. I had 3 new children, and I felt like no sponsors, and I felt alone. I felt responsible for his death. And then I learned something wonderful about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had 100 sponsors because the entire program of Alcoholics Anonymous came to help us through that great tragedy. Everybody was there holding our hands, helping me to realize that I'm not God and that I don't make those decisions, and helping me stay sober. And, you know, it never occurred to me to take a pill or a drink. In the worst tragedy of my life, it never occurred to me to take a pill or a drink. And that's the power of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Today I can see a little beauty in that. An autopsy showed that Jimmy Johnson had terminal cancer. And God allowed him to die in the act of helping another human being, which was the way he had lived. And he died with a smile on his face. And I can be grateful for that. The most glorious day and the most traumatic time, all at one time. It helps to reinforce the one day at a time for me. Because when Jimmy said we can't predict the future, he surely did not know that he had 2 minutes. So the one day at a time is particularly profound to me through that. Every area of my life has improved because of the recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. Things have happened to me that I have to pinch myself to even believe. I am involved right now in dreams I didn't even know I had. They were God's dreams for me, and I was not even aware. The relationship I have with my children is a oneness. It is so special. It's so real and so powerful. I had a special time 2 weeks ago when I spoke at the women's conference in Atlanta. And my 2 girls were in the audience. And I did not know it until I had spoken. And afterwards they came running up to me, throwing their arms around me, and surprised me by being there in that audience. One of those girls had called me, had seen me the week before when I came home from work, and said, "Mom, I am so glad you're here. You are the only person in the world who understands the way I feel." And it is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that has given us that relationship, that closeness, and that communication. And they are special, special people, stronger because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life and because of their own experiences with alcoholism. One of the girls called me from a vacation trip in the Keys. We're not immune to bizarre things happening to us. She called me from a vacation trip in the Keys and she said, "Mom, you would not believe what is happening to us down here. Such and such and such," and she went on to describe this rather bizarre incident. And I share it with you because of her attitude about it. She said, I just called to tell you because the minute we get home, we are going to start writing our book. There is no way anybody would ever believe what happens to this family. Her attitude about it. This is a child who has had so many adjustments to make that she can really adjust well to anything. There have been so many things happening to her in her little life that another thing, bizarre or not, is just not really a big deal. And that's one of the positive outcomes of living with alcoholism. So I have a son and two daughters. My son is a sophomore at the University of Georgia, and I just hope that this afternoon you will find it in your heart to say, how about them dogs? And he knew he was going to miss me for the weekend, and he came home early yesterday so that we could have some time together. Special relationships that I am so grateful for. My career is out of sight. I have to just believe that I am doing what God wants me to do because it has all come to me. I have not pursued any of it. When I had been out of Peachford Hospital for, I was so scared to go home, as I told you. And what I did was provide myself an outpatient program by going back to Peachford every day. Now, you have to understand, I could see the back door of my house from the front door of Peachford Hospital, but scared to death to be there with all those nightmare memories. So I would go back to Peachford every day and sit. And one day I was sitting there, and the nurse came through and said, one of the nurses didn't show up in detox today. Would you like to go down there and work? And I said, yeah. Wonderful. They paid me $2.45 an hour. I made up beds. Coming from a wealthy lifestyle, it was like the paycheck of a millionaire to me. $2.45 was like millionaire's money to me. I loved it. And the main thing was I could make a contribution. That's the main thing. I could be productive. I hadn't even been able to go to the grocery store for months and come home with anything on my list. I could make up a bed. I could empty bedpans. I could haul trays to detox, and I was useful. And it meant so much to me. I took such pride in that job. And I was promoted to counselor later on. And then I was promoted to follow-up care coordinator, telephoning former patients to find out how they were doing. And then, lo and behold, Joint Commission came along and said, you've got to have an aftercare program. And who was sitting in the logical place to write and design and develop the aftercare program but the person doing follow-up, telephone calls? So God gave that opportunity to me, and I wrote the program for Peachford, and it became a national model for other treatment centers. Me the most surprised of all. And there I was. I had been in DTs not too terribly many years earlier in that very hospital, and now I was the aftercare coordinator. I like to say in my story that I had that dubious distinction of being the only staff member who went from DTs to aftercare coordinator. And I worked there 5 years, and I feel like I made a contribution there. And the contribution they made to me is immeasurable. I went to graduate school at the University of Georgia later, but graduate school could not hold a candle to the education that I got working at Peachford Hospital for 5 years, doing everything there was to do there from the bottom. I started in this field from the bottom, the very first thing you can do, and that's empty bedpans. And I am so grateful for that education. I went to Ridgeview Institute and worked there for 3 years and began working with companies there, being the liaison between the treatment center and companies. And one day when I least expected it, God came to me and through some other people and gave me an opportunity to open my own center. And it was not even a goal of mine. It wasn't even a goal. It was just delivered to me, just put in my lap. And I have my own center now called the Atlanta Resource Center, and I work with companies helping troubled employees. And they send their troubled employees to me, and I guarantee you 50% of the time it's an alcohol and drug problem. And I'll tell you something else. The other 50% of the time, those people don't have any idea how much AA they get. And I love my job. I just love it. It is a dream I didn't even know I had coming true for me right now. I just love it. Every day, it's like an AA meeting in my office. We have lunch every day with somebody in the program. Every day, two or three people in the program come by and have coffee with us. It's wonderful. Somebody did an internship with me recently from Georgia State University, and she said, "I have never seen such love as there is in this office." Well, that love is there because I need it. That love is there because I have created an environment that I need, and that is by bringing the program of Alcoholics Anonymous into my work environment and by surrounding myself with the people that I love the most, and that is the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. It is a special, special time for me. I know this is what God wants me to do. I feel that I am useful. I'm so glad that God has not asked me to read about life in a book. Most people, most women especially my age, have to read in a book what I have been allowed to experience. I am so grateful for that. I'm glad that God chose me to be one of the people that got to live. I'm grateful for the hard parts, and I am grateful for the glorious parts. And I wouldn't swap a single one. Not a single experience would I swap. There's a whole lot I wouldn't repeat, but I would not swap any of it. To be where I am today and to have the feeling that I have in my heart today, I just wouldn't swap it for anything. I'm just so grateful. I want to share with you the thought for the day. On October the 27th, which happens to be my sponsor's birthday, one reason it's special to me. The other reason it's special to me is because it says how I feel about myself and how I feel about my sobriety. And it's a real treasure to me. It says, "I can help my fellow alcoholic. I am of some use in the world. God has given me a new lease on life so that I can help my fellow alcoholic. My life has purpose and it has direction. God has spared me all the hazards of my alcoholic life to bring me at last to a place of real usefulness in this world. He has let me live for this. It is my opportunity and my destiny. At last, I am worth something, and I feel it, and I owe that to a God of my understanding who, more important, understood me and knew what I needed, and in his infinite, if severe, mercy, gave me alcoholism, and it has been a gift. Thank you for letting me be with you. I love you."